She woke up in the middle of the night with like a desperate sense that she needs to pray for me, that like there's spiritual warfare and like crazy things happening. And I was like, that's weird, because I'm not feeling any weirdness. And like an hour before this, I am like losing my mind. I am like foggy. My words aren't coming clearly. I feel like I'm just a mess. And I say all of that at the beginning, not to make an excuse or not to say like, so lower your expectations. Actually, the opposite. I say that at the beginning to say that I feel like the Lord has an incredibly important word tonight, and that he's going to speak it in spite of me tonight. So please, after you hear this amazing message that I think the Lord has for you, okay, don't leave going, hi, person. Somebody waved at me. That's why I waved back. After you hear this amazing message that's from the Lord for you, don't leave saying, wow, Nate preached something really cool, even though his brain is like vanilla pudding right now. What I hope you say is that Jesus really was working in spite. All right, so we are in week 4 of a series called Major Kingdom Impact from Minor Biblical Characters. We've been looking at people in the scriptures who maybe we would pass over without maybe noticing, but that actually have these really rich and amazing contributions to what God is doing. And tonight, I am still excited, and even though I feel like crazy right now, that we're talking about this character that is found in the Old Testament named Mephibosheth. All right? I get excited. Super weird name. Let's all say it together, and I think it'll just be a great group exercise. So on three, we'll say Mephibosheth. One, two, three. Gesundheit. All right. Wonderful. And before we talk about Mephibosheth, I feel like obligated to update you on my daughter, Rosie, because she's real cute, and I haven't brought her around because her bedtime has changed, and you guys haven't been able to see the cute, but it's amazing, okay? And I think we have pictures. I brought pictures. I did it. I did the dad thing. Look at that. She's eating like a beet leaf in the second picture. Don't you want to be friends with her? So this is what happens. My friend Mallory was like, oh, you have a little girl, she's going to be able to get away with anything. And I'm like, no, no, no. Like, I don't know. Like, we're going to have a discipline in the Bebout house. Just because she's cute doesn't mean she gets away with stuff, right? And some of the anxiety that my wife and I had when Rosie was first born was because she cries for a variety of reasons. And when you are a parent of a newborn, you have no idea what those reasons are. Right? You're just like, just talk to me. Tell me what I need to do to fix you and the stop of the noise. And you don't know, and you're like checking for pee and poop, and you're like trying to feed her, and like, and you can't figure it out. But the cool thing is, as they get older, even though she's not vocal now, Leah and I have like learned Rosie, right? And so now I know most of the time what the issue is when she's crying, right? And so it was that I found myself like 2 nights ago, and I was putting her in her little cute little footsie sleeper thing that she goes to bed in. And she was crying just because she was annoyed at how long the process was taking. And I knew this because I now know these things. And so she's crying and she's like being so unhelpful. Like, just close your stupid fist and it goes through easier than if you try to grab the stupid cloth on the way. Anyways. So she's crying and all this stuff. And I go, hey. Like, I did that thing, and I snapped her out of it, and she stopped crying, and she looked at me, and I was like, here it is, discipline, right? She is going to listen to her father, and I looked at her, and then she did this thing, which is a new thing, and she just wiggled. She goes, and I was like, oh, what a sweet girl, and all the discipline went out the window, right? And all the, I think I might be a little bit too hot, Steve, because I'm getting feedback here. But all of that stuff that I was planning on, you know, just kind of evaporated quickly. And so you might say that she wiggled out of it. All right. I'm on fire tonight. I take back everything I said. I'm really feeling it. Okay, good. Speaking of being able to get away, also, one more thing. We're going to get to Mephibosheth, but I want to do some things to set it up. So it's going to feel incredibly like we're all over the place, but there's a plan. Okay, good. So speaking of getting away with murder, Genghis Khan. Do you know about this guy? Have you taken a history course? Genghis Khan was this, like, insane conqueror of, like, many places. He conquered all of that area that's, like, in the red. And my thesis statement for this section of the sermon is called Genghis Khan is not to be trifled with, okay? I'm going to talk to you about that a little bit. But this guy was really prolific in his, like, world domination, so much so that currently alive today in the world, he has 16 million living direct descendants. I mean, he was doing a little more than just conquering. You know what I'm talking about? brother had some game. And literally, like, one out of every 200 guys is a descendant. Probably not anybody in this room. But, like, that's a lot of people. And he conquered the Mongol Empire, stretched over 9.2 million square miles, okay? That's 16% of all the land mass in the world. That's what he did. That's how he threw down. And I found this incredible story about him this week that I was like, this is awesome. So I found out this story about Genghis Khan, that as his empire was expanding, they were bumping up against other empires. And Mongols, you know, they didn't do agriculture or anything like that. And so they needed to trade with other people groups to, like, make their things work. So Genghis Khan sent emissaries to this other empire. It was called the Khwarezmid Empire. And his emissaries were trying to establish trade routes between that kingdom and the Mongol Empire. And the governor of one of these cities decided he didn't like Genghis Khan's cronies coming in and offering trade. And so this governor killed Genghis Khan's representatives. And then we're going to return to my thesis statement shortly. So this is what Genghis Khan does in response to, like, a handful of his dudes getting killed when he's trying to reach out to this other empire. Genghis Khan takes 200,000 people and conquers that empire, finds the governor who killed his men, and pours liquid hot silver down his eyes and throat, right? This is like a Game of Thrones action here. As a matter of fact, the Dothraki in George Martin's Game of Thrones are based on the Mongols. I'm a nerd, whatever. Okay. But that wasn't enough. That wasn't enough. Genghis Khan was so annoyed that he overtook the empire. He brutally killed this guy, and then he diverted a river to wash out that guy's hometown so it never existed. Which brings me back to my thesis statement, Genghis Khan is not to be trifled with, right? Like, this, like, he wiped that city off of the map. He can do that. He did it. It happened, okay? And what I really think is interesting about this whole thing is we understand this, like, don't mess with, like, powerful people who are, like, in charge of things, who have the ability to, like, mess you up, because they can do it, and they will do it. And it's a really interesting parallel, because there's this story in the Gospel of Luke that Jesus tells. It's a parable that I want to share with you that sounds really, really similar to the story I just shared with you about Genghis Khan. So this is in Luke 20. It's verses 9 through 16. So if you have your Bibles, turn to Luke 20 with me. It's going to be on the screen behind me also. This is the story that Jesus says, okay? Jesus went on to tell the people this parable. A man planted a vineyard and rented it to some farmers and went away for a long time. At harvest time, he sent a servant to the tenants so they would give him some of the fruit of the vineyard. But the tenants beat him, and sent him away empty-handed. He sent another servant, but they also beat him and treated him shamefully and sent him away empty-handed. He sent a third, and they wounded him and threw him out. Then the owner of the vineyard said, "What shall I do? I'll send my son, whom I love. Perhaps they will respect him." But when the tenants saw him, they talked the matter over. "This is the heir," they said. "Let's kill him, and the inheritance will be ours." So they threw him out of the vineyard, and they killed him. What then will the owner of the vineyard do to them? He will come and kill those tenants and give the vineyard to others. When the people heard this, they said, "God forbid it." Now, Jesus is giving us a parable of something that sounds pretty similar to the situation with Genghis Khan. But he's talking about it not of a crazy, you know, Mongol emperor, but rather a actual God who created all of life. And the people's response to this is fitting because they said, "I hope that's not how the story goes. I hope that's not how it goes, because if God is going to, in fact, put out his retribution, if he is going to exact justice for us, for mistreating his prophets and for crucifying his son, then we are really up a creek without a paddle." And so I want to draw this comparison for you. Okay, so we saw Genghis Khan, not to be trifled with. I'm going to adjust my thesis statement, and we're going to talk about Yahweh, okay? So Genghis Khan, he conquered 16% of the mass of Earth, like the land mass, but Yahweh, he owns much larger territory, right? Like, the God of our universe is in charge of 100% of both the land and the sea that we inhabit, and also everything else that is, okay? And so I made a little nice little thing here, visual. There's the Earth, and it's hard to see, but like within the Earth, we are a solar system, and then the next one over, that third thing, is like those are all the stars in our neighborhood, right? And then there's the Milky Way galaxy. And for like a long time, scientists just thought that was it. Like our galaxy and the millions and billions of stars that inhabit our galaxy was just all that there was. And then we got like even more powerful telescopes. And now we know that there's like these clusters. And so once you get to like the seventh and the eighth picture and you see all those little dots, it's a little hard to see. Those aren't stars. Those aren't galaxies. Those are, all of those dots are superclusters of hundreds of thousands of galaxies, like billions, trillions, unthinkable amount of stars, right? And we should also note that this is just the observable universe. Like scientists are like totally sure that there's like way more out there that we just can't see it yet because the technology hasn't progressed, right? So this is a big God. He owns a lot of real estate, right? And Genghis Khan may have like diverted a river to wipe out a town, but we know that in the scriptures that God once flooded the globe, right? as he was upset with things. So God, I want to say Genghis Khan, okay, yeah, not to be trifled with, but compared to Yahweh, he's like a kitty cat, right? Like the God that we know and serve is all powerful, right? And so you would hope that we would never be in a position where we would attract his ire, that we would attract his wrath or his vengeance or his retribution, but that's actually exactly where we find ourselves in. It's exactly where we're at. We've broken his laws. We've broken his commandments. We are ourselves full of sin and like, that's not a super awesome place to be like in opposition to the most powerful thing that's ever been. And this brings us to Mephibosheth, okay? Because this is why I love this story. Because this story, I think, so exemplifies the heart of God, and for me, makes it really tangible and really understandable that even though we deserve one thing, God gives us another. So Mephibosheth is a story that comes out of 2 Samuel. So if you have your Bibles and you like doing that, we can flip together to 2 Samuel. Starting in chapter 9, we're actually going to be in all of chapter 9. I'm going to just walk us through this thing. 2 Samuel chapter 9 starts in verse 1. David asked, "Is there anyone still left of the house of Saul to whom I can show kindness for Jonathan's sake?" Now there was a servant of Saul's household named Ziba. They called him to appear before David, and the king said to him, "Are you Ziba?" "At your service," he replied. The king asked, "Is there no one still left from the house of Saul to whom I can show God's kindness?" Ziba answered the king, "There is still a son of Jonathan. He is crippled in both feet." "Where is he?" David asked. Ziba answered, "He's at the house of Machir, son of Amiel, in Lo Debar." We're going to pause here for a minute to give you some background context that I think would be very helpful. So, David, King David, is now ruling over the nation of Israel. And this is significant because he's the second king in Israel's history. The first king was this guy named Saul, right? And Saul did not like David. Saul had a son named Jonathan, and he and David were best friends. But Saul often tried to kill David because he was kind of jealous of him and the favor that the Lord had on his life. So has anyone had a friend that, like, their parents, like, didn't like him a little bit? Like, I was always that kid in high school that, like, my friend's parents were like, "We don't really like Nate." None of them tried to kill me that I know of. So this is, like, important, right? So Saul is trying to kill David all the time, and it never works out, and the Lord protects him. And eventually, Saul dies, and David, in fact, becomes king. Now, this is the important thing to know. Mephibosheth is Saul's grandson. He's the son of Jonathan, David's friend. And what would normally happen, this is just routine operating procedure. You need to understand this. Whenever some king would take over after a previous king's reign, it was just like normal practice to kill all of their descendants. You need to do that. It's important in the ancient world because then none of them can come back later and like make a claim for the throne. Does that make sense? Like they would just, it doesn't matter if they're like a baby, like 1 year old, they'd kill them because they might grow up someday and like do like a Mufasa thing, right? And like come back and reclaim the throne. So Mephibosheth, as soon as Saul passes away, his life is in danger. And as a matter of fact, you know, they mention that he's lame in both of his feet. The Bible tells us in chapter 4, a few chapters ahead of this, that how he becomes lame, how he becomes crippled, is that they come to his house and tell his nanny, "Hey, Saul is dead." And she's like afraid that the army's going to come soon and try to kill this kid. So she picks up Mephibosheth, 5 years old, and drops him in her way out the door, and he becomes crippled. It's this crazy thing. It's super sad. And so his life, Mephibosheth's life, has not been awesome, right? I can't imagine how sad and frustrating that might have been. Just today, this is just like the kind of day I've had. It's been awesome. But I came home for lunch, and I was hanging out with my wife, and Rosie was just, you saw the pictures, how cute. And she was just being so sweet and loving. And I brought her in the kitchen, and I sat her on the floor of the kitchen, and she was just like playing and stuff. I ate some lunch, which included bread from Hawkins that came in a bag. I put the bread in the bag and tied it, and I turned around, and Rosie looked up at me, and she had full of like eyes of trust and love, and I was like, "Hey, Rosie," and I swung the bag a couple times, just like, I thought, how fun is this? You know, she's going to love me swinging a bag of bread. I might end up suing Hawkins because these bags are not stable. And honest to goodness, I swing the bag and the bread loaf flies out of the bottom of the thing, knocks her right in the forehead. And she's got, like, she can sit up, but, like, that's basically it. And so there wasn't even, like, she just was like, "Here we go," and just like slowly fell backwards and conked her little head on the kitchen floor. And I was like, "Yeah!" And I like threw that damn bread and I picked up my daughter and, you know, so frustrating. And she's crying, and I'm trying to console her, and she's like pushing my face away, like, you're the one who did it. I don't want you, you know. And so my wife comes in, and I hand Rosie to Leah, and of course she stops crying, and she's like looking at me all accusatory. And I think she's going to have daddy issues when she grows up. No. So this is the scene, right? Like this nanny who's trying to rescue this kid, who's trying to help, who's trying to get him to safety, ends up dropping him, and he becomes crippled. Like he can't walk, he can't use his feet. And this is significant because in the ancient world, like people with disabilities were for sure second-class citizens. Like they were considered like kind of judged by God, right? And so people kind of stayed away from him. So we've got this descendant of Saul. Saul is no longer the king, who the community looks at and says, you know, God doesn't love this kid because he's crippled now, you know. God's favor has moved over to David. And then David says, I need to track down, is there anyone of Saul's descendants still alive, right? Yes, this is the exact sound that I get a lot of times when I talk. Good. So is there any of Saul's descendants still alive? And they say, yeah, and they go find this guy. So this is what I want to communicate. This is the sense I want to communicate. When somebody comes to Mephibosheth's door and says, hey, the king wants to see you, what do you think he's thinking? I am about to die. Like, for sure. Somehow he tracked me down. Somehow I got found out. Somehow he found out that I exist. Like, I'm getting called to the principal's office, and this guy's going to wipe me out, right? And so that's exactly probably what he thinks. And so we pick up in verse 5, and it says this. So King David had him brought from Lo-Debar, from the house of Machir, son of Amiel. When Mephibosheth, son of Jonathan, the son of Saul, came to David, he bowed down to pay him honor. And David said, Mephibosheth, because everybody loves saying that guy's name. Your servant, at your service, he replied. Don't be afraid, David said to him, for I will surely show you kindness for the sake of your father Jonathan. I will restore to you all the land that belonged to your grandfather Saul, and you will always eat at my table. Mephibosheth bowed down and said, what is your servant that you should notice a dead dog like me? We're going to pause there for a moment. So Mephibosheth gets brought before the king, and instead of, I'm sorry, I know you've lived a hard life, I know things have not been fair for you, but you have to die, what Mephibosheth hears from David is, you know all the land that your grandfather used to own? And he would go, yeah, all of Israel? Yeah, I know that place. He would go, I'm going to give it back to you. And you're going to be at my table from here on out, meaning you're going to be seated at a place of honor by the king. So this guy who once experienced shame his whole life, he comes into the presence of the king, and David says, yeah, I know people have not treated you well, and people have thought that you were cursed because of your brokenness. But what I'm here to tell you is that you are going to occupy a seat of honor in my presence for the rest of your life, right? And Mephibosheth's response, I think, is very telling. And he says, who am I that you would notice a dead dog like me? I really think that this isn't self-effacement. I don't think he's trying to, like, suck up to David. David's already told him good news. This is what I think is really happening here. I think Mephibosheth has really bought into the idea that he's worthless and he's not able to receive love. Does that make sense? He's really bought into the idea because his whole life people have been probably ostracizing him, ignoring him, probably reminding him that God's favor is no longer with his family. And I really think that Mephibosheth, that's how he views himself. That's his identity now. And this is the thing that I think is true for us. I think sometimes we get invited into the presence of the king. We get invited into God's house. We get invited to interact with Jesus, and our first thought is, oh no, here we go. He finally found out that I did this, or okay, I knew I was going to have to pay for this eventually, and here's the day, right? And we come into the presence of the Lord, and he says, no, no, no. By my grace and by my blood, you're forgiven, you're restored. As a matter of fact, I'm going to give you a place of honor at my table, and our response to him is like, I'm not worthy of this, right? My identity is broken and useless and unlovable. I don't understand what you're trying to do to me. I think the rest of this passage kind of helps us with this, right? 2 Samuel 9:9-13. The king summoned Ziba, Saul's servant, and said to him, I've given your master's grandson everything that belonged to Saul and his family. You and your sons and your servants are to farm the land for him and bring in the crops so that your master's grandson may be provided for. And Mephibosheth, grandson of your master, will always eat at my table. Ziba had 15 sons and 20 servants. So, like, Mephibosheth just gets a staff. There you go. Then Ziba said to the king, your servant will do whatever the Lord the king commands. And Mephibosheth ate at David's table like one of the king's sons. Mephibosheth had a young son named Micah, and all the members of Ziba's household were servants of Mephibosheth. And Mephibosheth lived in Jerusalem because he always ate at the king's table. He was crippled in both. So, Mephibosheth comes. David, instead of giving him retribution or punishment, gives him grace. Mephibosheth goes, that doesn't work. I'm not worthy. That's not who I am. I'm not the guy who receives grace. I'm the guy who everybody spits on the side of the road. And then David gives more grace. And more grace, and more honor, and more honor, right? He's like, oh yeah, check this out. Now you've got a staff of 40 people. They're going to farm the land for you. They're going to make you really rich, right? Obviously, at some point, Mephibosheth got busy and had a son, right? So what was previously like no one would ever go near him, now his wealth and power has attracted a wife and a spouse, and he's able to have a family. And this thing I love, he ate at the king's table. He moved into Jerusalem. That's not where he was from, right? He's from Lodabar. But he moves to Jerusalem because every night he's got an appointment, he's eating with the king. He's seated at a seat of honor in the king's presence. And so no more is he known as Mephibosheth, the guy who was cursed by God, who was forgotten by God, who's somebody who is broken. No. Now his identity isn't the dead dog. Now his identity is Mephibosheth, the guy who eats with the king every single night. David completely changes the trajectory of this guy's life in an instant. And what I love about this story is the scriptures say this about King David, that he was a man after God's own heart, right? And so I think this story for us is an insight into the Father's love for each and every one of us. No matter what you've done, no matter how broken you are, no matter how you feel in your heart, like your identity is unworthy, unlovable, unforgivable, what does God do? He lavishes grace upon grace upon grace. And he takes you and he sits you at a seat of honor. And he changes your very identity. And he says, you're no longer unlovable, unforgivable, but now you're the person that everybody looks to and sees that God loves outrageously. Isn't that good? I think that's real good. That's good news, right? So this is what we'll do. I want us to kind of just rest in that tonight. I feel like, you know, there's a lot going on, and people are very busy, and I know people are stressed out because the semester's over in like 2.5 weeks. And I just feel like maybe the Lord wants you to rest in that reality. There's no like call to response to this. There's no like, and therefore go and do this. I don't feel like that's what the Lord has for us. I feel like what the Lord has for you tonight is like, can you listen and own the fact that I love you outrageously? And instead of judging you and cursing you, I've instead placed you in a seat of honor because Jesus Christ's blood covers you and I welcome you in to my house as sons and daughters of the living God. Does that make sense? So we're going to take communion because I love this idea of we're invited to have a meal with the Lord. We're invited to be at the table of the Lord. And I think that some of us still get confused from time to time how God works, including myself, right? I get confused. I think that it's my performance and my obedience and my holiness that earns me standing in God's presence, right? It's my behavior that determines the fact that I still get a seat at the table. And I think that's a real confusion with the way that the Lord works. I feel like I'm in good company, though, because we see the disciples struggling with this concept all the time, right? And in the scenes leading up to the Last Supper in the Gospel of John, we see the disciples really struggling with this concept, right? Because they keep asking for seats of honor. Remember this? The disciples are like bickering amongst themselves. Who will be greatest when the Lord comes into his kingdom? Two of the disciples have their mom go ask Jesus, which is just like the best thing in the world. Hey, mom, will you go ask Jesus if we can sit at his right and left hand when he comes into his glory? Right? These guys are like jockeying over position, right? They think somehow that their performance, that their obedience, that their, you know, following the rules is going to earn them standing, is going to get them seated at places of honor in Jesus' kingdom. And he's like, you have no clue how this works. You have no clue how this works. And in John 13, they're gathering together for the last meal. And what would be common in the ancient Jewish world, when you come inside from outside and when you're getting ready to eat a meal together, someone would come through and wash everyone's feet, right? They were dirty, they were messy, they were stinky, and they were like a sense of being refreshed. We talked about being refreshed tonight, right? Like there's a sense of like you wash your feet and you just feel better, like I feel like clean and like able to enjoy the night. And so here we are, the disciples and Jesus in the upper room, getting ready to have their very last meal together. And they know somebody needs to go around. There was a sneeze. Okay. Praise the Lord. Nobody said Mephibosheth. That's good. So the disciples are up there, and they know that somebody needs to go around washing feet, but none of those guys are willing to do it, right? They keep thinking they're going to climb the ladder. They're not going to, like, lower themselves in the eyes of these competitors. No, they want to be seated at the right hand of God. They want to be seated at a place of honor, right? So nobody's volunteering to wash anybody's feet. And this is where Jesus comes in and goes, you guys don't understand anything. And he takes off his outer robe, and he washes their feet. And it gets real uncomfortable, and Peter's like, I'm not letting you do this to me, you know? Like, this is like work of a servant, and you are my master. And Jesus goes, this is the way I work. If you don't let me wash your feet, there's no relationship here. And I think the thing that we keep getting confused that Jesus reminds us of is we think it's about our performance and our behavior that earns right standing, and Jesus is like, not even close. Not even close. As a matter of fact, I'm going to serve you. I'm going to come and pour my life out for you. I'm going to sit you at a place of honor when you feel like you're the least deserving of it. Does that make sense? I'm going to honor you in the very place that you feel like you are the least deserving person, because in that moment you will know that it's been all by my grace that you have been freed and restored. Not by anything you've done. What you have earned in your life is retribution. what you have earned is like condemnation. But what Jesus gives is grace upon grace upon grace. And he lavishes it. I love that word that's used so often in the New Testament to describe the way that Jesus gives grace. He does it lavishly. Right? And the very, our ability to come to the table and take communion is because of that grace. He's welcomed us to the table. He's erased all of our wrongs by his blood. He's completely cleansed us and made us pure, and he invites us to come and sit at a seat of honor as daughters and sons of the living God because he's just that good. He's just that good. So I'm going to have Joe and Caitlin come back up. We're going to continue to worship. And I pray that as we come forward to take communion tonight, that it will be ripe with the sense of God's amazing, stupefying grace, right? That even though we deserve one thing, he completely amazes us and gives us blessing upon blessing, grace upon grace. I just think that's like all you need tonight. You need to sit in the fact that through Jesus Christ, God has elevated you and put you in a seat of honor. You need to receive truth from him and say, and hear him say to you, no matter where you've gone, how far you've been, how broken you seem, I have the ability to forgive, to restore, and to elevate you to the heavenly realms. And that's what he does on our behalf. Practical things will just come centerly and take the elements. We have bread, we have juice, we'll practice intinction, which is a fancy way of saying dipping bread into the juice and take communion, and then you can return to your seats from the outside. So that's a practical thing. Don't all feel like you have to come up at once like a bunch of robots. There's going to be three songs in the second worship set. Come when you feel like you are ready to receive the grace that God wants to lavishly pour out on you. Come when you feel like you're ready to wrap your mind around the fact that because of what Jesus Christ has done on your behalf, God says you are pure.